You are listening to the Valeo Mentis podcast.
On this episode, you'll meet Dr. Scott Hancock. We discuss growing up at Churchill Downs, his time at vet school, moving to Georgia to start a referral hospital, creative ways he broke through roadblocks, time spent abroad, his guidance for young vets, and much more.
Here on Valeo Mentis, the goal is to shrink the veterinary world by connecting people together through stories and helpful resources. So listen closely and enjoy.
Let's just start from the beginning. All right, where are you from? Where did the horses come into play? And yeah, let me just hear the backstory.
Well, I was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and my family, we bought a small farm in Shelby County, Kentucky, which is between Louisville and Lexington. We weren't big-time horse people. I think everybody in Kentucky either owned a tobacco patch or a couple hopeful racehorses. We, like many Kentuckians, we had a few horses and hoped we would produce a Derby horse, but unfortunately, ours never met payroll. But it was a good childhood. I enjoyed it. My dad worked at a distillery. We had this hobby farm, and we just really enjoyed it. And so I was fortunate that I met a fellow that was a veterinarian, equine veterinarian, and he went to Churchill Downs several mornings a week. And then he had a mobile ambulatory practice. And he was kind enough to literally pick me up 4:30 in the morning. If I had school days off or if he was working Saturdays, he would pick me up and I rode with him. And he was a great mentor, very encouraging. And it just, like many of us in the horse world, something lit our fire. And I thought that would be a fun gig. And so I guess about 10 years of age, I decided to pursue veterinary medicine, or at least I thought I wanted to. And fortunately, a little trials and tribulations, I was able to do that, and honestly have really enjoyed it. I wouldn't trade it for anything. There's things I would do different, smarter, perhaps, but overall, it's been a fantastic journey.
Tell us about the days as a boy working at Churchill, and what did you learn from that?
Well, it was interesting. You know, my dad used to say it was a lesson in life, and it was that, you know, we were called grooms. I think you had to be 14 to be a groom. Most of us were maybe 9, 10 years old on the shady side of being legal. And I worked for a few trainers, and they lock us in the tack room. They were good people, but we'd kind of travel the circuit. We'd hit Churchill and a couple of local tracks and travel with the horses for a week or two or three. And it was fun. And it was amazing, the people, the horses. You know, thoroughbreds on the track are a little bit excitable, different than the horses we had at home. And yet it was an art to those Kentuckians. There was a way to bed a stall. There was a way to rub a horse down. There was a very detailed way to bandage a leg, and I'm sure I did all of them incorrectly initially, but they kind of stayed on you and taught you to do it right. And I really enjoyed it. It's funny, from the old gentlemen that were called hot walkers that walked the shed rule and cooled these horses off to the trainers and assistant trainers, it was a whole array of characters. You could write a novel. I can remember coming home and telling my dad, so-and-so, man, Dad, he's on top of his game. He's driving a big Cadillac, and he's got a big horseshoe diamond ring on, and the saying in Kentucky, he's in tall cotton. And my dad would kind of grin and say, well, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And it's funny, they were called meets. So you have a race in the fall, and then there'd be another meet somewhere else, Ellis Park or whatever. And later you'd see that same trainer that was with the monogram sunglasses, and he sold his Cadillac. He was probably drinking Evan Williams whiskey by the half pint in his hip pocket. And by golly, he was walking hot. So it was a lesson to me about feast of famine. You know, it was amazing. And the bigger you are, the harder you fall. And it was amazing what horses and people and all the little blends of personalities did. But I worked for some vets that kind of looked out for me and treated me almost like a son and encouraged me and kept me out of the pits of the racetrack. Because there was, back then, it was kind of a shady business. There was a lot of stuff going on that I'm glad I really didn't understand or participate in. There wasn't a lot of drug screening. And if anything new that came in, if it was supposedly introduced as a miracle drug or item from Canada or France or wherever, everybody was all over it, you know, hoping the horse might come out of the gate a little faster and a little harder. And I grew up seeing a lot of that. And unfortunately, that, you know, in those early years, there were some horses that suffered, you know, with non-science-based medicine. And fortunately, that's improved a lot. But it was fascinating, from the owners to the grooms to the guys that hauled these horses. A lot of these Sally van line drivers that were moving horses from Saratoga to Churchill and Churchill to Gulfstream, you kind of got to recognize some of their faces, and they all had a story. They were just part of the puzzle of life, and they kind of put it together and made it flow. So I really enjoyed it.
So from there, what brought you to Georgia? Tell us that story. And I guess maybe I skipped out on vet school, but do you have any fond memories from vet school, or was it just kind of a...
Well, I think we all do. I'll be the first to confess. I went to University of Kentucky. I lived on a farm called Main Chance Farm that was owned by Elizabeth Arden. Honestly, I think she had already passed time I was there, but I was on a student work study program, and the housing condition was not very favorable. I was sort of ashamed living there, and I certainly didn't advertise it, but it was a way for a long shot to get through. And they had thoroughbreds there, and I got to drive in a university truck and a trailer. There were donated stallion breedings to different stallions. University had a band of mares that were just sort of mediocre. Most of them were given as a tax write-off. So I got to go to Claiborne and Bluegrass Farms. I got to see some nice farms hauling these mares to the breeding shed, and then work with some veterinarians in Lexington. Became a friend with a sales agent that prepped a lot of horses. And so I worked every Keeneland sale through college. And really enjoyed it. Again, another really rich experience. It was a lesson in life. It was a lesson about people. You sure learn to not judge a book by the cover. You could find a gruff guy and smell the bourbon on him, and he's half shaved and smell like cigars, and he might be the richest oil man in Texas. And then you'd have a guy dressed very dapperly, and he looked the role, he played the role, but probably wouldn't have known a good piece of horse flesh if it bit him in the butt. So there was sort of a variety. So I went to UK, had a degree in animal science, worked full-time through college. I applied to vet school the first time. At that time, there were 13 people accepted into Auburn from the state of Kentucky. And I remember going to the mailbox one Friday and getting that letter that started "We regret," and how disappointing. But I perseverance, people encouraged me. I decided I couldn't give it up, and by the grace of the good Lord, I got into vet school and enjoyed it, and worked through vet school. We sold baked goods. I hauled pecans from vet school to Ohio and brought back smoked cheeses and bolognas. If there's a will, there's a way. I guess the title that "I'm not all closed gates are locked" is kind of fitting, because you got to kind of look at your circumstances, and you can either be bitter or better, or you can spend a lot of wasted energy making excuses, or you can figure out now I'm here, I've got to figure out how to stay. I got to study, which I had to study, and I've got to work. So you kind of have to figure out how to make it flow, and somehow another, I was able to do that and enjoyed the experience immensely. Got out of vet school, and Auburn has a program called a preceptorship. It's your last 3 months of vet school prior to graduating. Well, I went to Lexington. That was, in my view, that was the promised land. That was the utopia for all wannabe horse veterinarians. I think maybe I was a good horse guy. I was handy. I grew up honest. I knew how to handle horses okay, and understood basic horsemanship. But like many veterinarians, you get out of school, it's only a license to learn. I had to learn the art of being a veterinarian. And obviously, a lot of that is confidence and repeatability. Well, I did my preceptorship there, and one of the great veterinarians, Dr. Norm Umfenauer, he was an icon in Lexington. He was at Gainesway Farm for many years as a stallion veterinarian, then ended up at Ashford Stud, one of the finest collection of thoroughbred stallions in the world. And this fellow was incredibly smart. He was handy. He was well-liked. But he really had a heart for young people, tried to encourage people to push and go further. And he took me to lunch one day and sort of broke my heart. He said, "Kid, you got all the right stuff, but you're in Lexington at the wrong time. The weanling and yearling market is horrible. Thoroughbreds aren't bringing the stud fee. And in many ways, it's kind of like the cattle market. Prices had dropped, and there were a lot of handy, seasoned, well-skilled veterinarians in Lexington in 1985 when I graduated that felt the squeeze. You know, the calls weren't coming in, and when they did have calls, there were clients that couldn't hardly pay their bill because the proceeds from Keeneland just wasn't meeting payroll. So he encouraged me to leave town and try to look at a horse as a horse and find rural America. And he said, get out there and learn the basics. And when this economy rolls back around and the thoroughbred market comes on strong again, then you'd have a little bit of the skill set to join a practice and perhaps bring some level of value or justification for your position. So that was a long day swallowing that because my whole dream was shattered. But then the phone rang a few days later and there were some veterinarians in Ohio. And the truth of it is they were, quote, large animal veterinarians, which means they did some dairy, they did some beef, and they did horses, but they were looking for a guy that was kind of horsey. And I guess I was horsey in that I really enjoyed horses, but I had a ton to learn about being a horse veterinarian. But I always tell young grads, I was fortunate enough to go in an area where there wasn't many attorneys. And many times I was the last stop before Alpo. These horse prices were really cheap. And there were a lot of Amish and Mennonite. There were fairground training centers. And I look back, it was a gift from the good Lord because it was a chance to learn without the threat and the liability. And I'm sure horses obviously may not have improved under my care, but I always... most of them did okay, and there's just no harm in trying. And I think horse people picked up my passion and enthusiasm and my willingness to call so many specialists all the time and address cases I was seeing. And through the years of phone calls and consults with credentialed veterinarian specialists, it really helped me get a little bit better handle on being a better general practitioner. So I wouldn't trade it for anything. It was a fantastic experience. I was there 3 years. It was fire engine, you know, lots of emergencies, barbed wire cuts, colics, swollens, kind of the run of the mill. The difference is that, you know, you're allowed to do your best, but you had to treat these horses many times for under $100. So you had to be a little bit creative. And I think it taught me a lot. And it gave me a little confidence. And then a classmate called. I was one of the guys, I guess, in our class. I was just kind of eaten up with horses. I just enjoyed it. I skipped small animal too much, much to my chagrin. I was always in the barn. If I heard a new case or a bizarre case came into the large animal hospital at Auburn, I'd find a way to get out of the small animal class, and because I'm just fascinated what the wizards would see, how they diagnose it, and what the protocol would be. And so the classmate says, come to Georgia. There's thoroughbred racing coming. There's not a private equine hospital in the state. I grew up in towns where private hospitals were kind of here and there. And I just thought that sounded like a great idea. So I traveled to Georgia and kicked up a little dirt. I actually rode with a few veterinarians that were in practice there and found out that, in fact, there was no clinic. There was no surgical hospital or referral place where you could keep horses overnight. And so I decided to move from Ohio and build the first private equine hospital in Georgia. And little did I know, we did that assuming, because there were several training centers moving in, but thoroughbred racing, truthfully, never got approved. So I borrowed a lot of money, built a fairly nice hospital. And here we are with this nice hospital. I hired a lot of talent, and racing never came, but we carved out a pretty good living. I met payroll. I had anywhere from 3 to 4 trucks on the road, and I had a boarded surgeon I hired from Belmont. I used to work for William O. Reed. I knew this fella, and some of my thoroughbred contacts, one of them being Jack Vanberg, a trainer, told me this guy had a lot of talent, a good set of hands, and just had good judgment. He kept saying he had good surgical judgment. And I had met him. He was doing an internship at Auburn when I was a senior, and I met him. And so I was able to talk him into coming to Georgia. So we really had a good run. We were like a band. I think we had some good songs, and we just seemed to function well together. We were all driven. All of us were from farms. Maybe that's to our chagrin, because we had a real strong work ethic. We drank a lot of coffee and kept late hours. It was nothing to come in the clinic 10:30, 11 at night, coming in from a long day at training barns or wherever we were, routine stuff, and share films. That's back when films were in brown envelopes. We'd put them up on the view box. We enjoyed having a boarded surgeon that we think had good judgment and lots of experience looking at orthopedic lesions. And so it was a great gig. And it was some fantastic years to be yoked with people like that. We're all still really good friends. Bob got recruited to go to Palm Beach. Bob Rizzi was our surgeon. Just a gifted guy, integrity, I can't think of any higher level of integrity and talent in one package. And when he left, he gave his notice nobly. But when he left, it's like I woke up and I realized I had this big yacht and I didn't have a captain. I'm not a surgeon. I have a gift of knowing how much I don't know and what I may not be good at. And I assisted Bob a few times. Not that he needed my assistance. I really appreciated surgery, but I hadn't paid my dues. I hadn't done a residency, and I thought it would be fraudulent for me just to assume, just because I had a hospital and the table and all the toys, that I could take up and leave where he left off. He left a deep furrow I don't think I could have filled. And so in time, a fella offered to buy the clinic. It was a private equine hospital. We had rented a little area for small animal to help with cash flow. None of us did small animal, but the guy that did the small animal approached us on buying the whole clinic, the brick barns with the stalls in it, in the surgery room and the treatment rooms would be like boarding and grooming. And honestly, he made an offer. I'd love to say I got rich. I didn't. But I got out of debt, and I think I slept till as late as 6 o'clock the next morning once I sold. And then we did ambulatory from my basement. I had bought a farm, and I had embryo recipients on the farm, and we did a lot of breeding. It sure wasn't Lexington, but we had people breeding warm bloods and quarter horses and paints and Arabs. That was real popular. It seemed like anything that had testicles and ovaries got bred back then. And we were relatively busy with breeding in the spring, and so it was easier to keep have clients ship mares to my farm for cooled semen or frozen semen. And we did several embryo transfers, not any huge number. We did enough. We were pretty good at them, but they were humbling. You do several in a row and think you were a wizard, and then the next one, you either don't get an embryo, or maybe you did get an embryo and you transplant it, and you'd look for it later by ultrasound and something went wrong. So it was a good gig.
Dr. Hancock, so when you moved to Georgia, I think other people might benefit from this story, but there were some people there that didn't have a lot of faith in you. You had some competition, or they saw you as competition, or they were intimidated in some way. Tell that story about what happened when you got to Georgia and started your practice.
Well, I look back and I don't blame them. The truth of it is I wasn't from Georgia. I grew up in Kentucky and I went to school at Auburn. I had all the strikes against me. Georgia has a fantastic veterinary school. They have a wealth of talent, and they turn out phenomenally good veterinarians. So you can imagine I came here and kicked the dirt around a little bit, and that was in a time where just about any bum could borrow a lot of money. And I had been going to hospital sales. I had a semi-load or two of surgical lights and trays and stuff kind of gathered. I used that as collateral and talked the bank into to loaning me money. And so we were building a hospital, and I guess it was kind of clueless. I assumed veterinarians that didn't want to sit on a belly all night or had a digital sheath infection or a complicated wound or something, I assumed it might be handy for them to have a local place. Where I grew up, a lot of the ambulatory veterinarians sent things in to what's called referral hospitals. But we tried to wine and dine some of the veterinarians, and I got a little negative feedback. I had a guy, I was scared to death. I was hearing rumors they didn't like me. They thought I was very arrogant to move into Georgia and build a private hospital without discussing it with them. And who was I? And I guess I look back, they were probably right. But I had a guy, I used about the last few bucks I had. We kind of wined and dined a group and invited them to a meeting. We were trying to tell them, look, we can cut bellies, Bob Brazee being the surgeon. You know, we have the equipment, the arthroscopic equipment, and Bob had done tiebacks and orthopedic abdominal surgery. It was just handy. You know, you get these really nasty digital sheath infections, and they're sort of hard to do on the farm. It's better to do it on gas anesthesia and get a better lavage and a better approach. And we thought they would receive it. Well, one particular fella stood up, and I think he had drank a little bit of the bourbon that I bought too much for. And he told me that he was back there gambling and he wouldn't give me a year. And he said, in fact, I think you'll be working. I don't know if they had Banfield, but I think you'll be working for Banfield or someone in a year. And, you know, it got real quiet. There I am. I'm scared to death. I'm over $1 million in debt. I had no family money. I just had heart. And so I kind of reared back and looked at him and I said, well, let's just meet in a year. You got a good point. And I admire your testicular fortitude to give us your opinion. So unless you get up at 3:30 or 4 like I have most of my life and you work till midnight, maybe, just maybe, and maybe I'm wrong, but maybe you got something to be afraid of. I'm not here to take business from you. I'm here to offer a service that's sort of local to the horse population. And but if you'd like, we'll meet in a year and we'll see where this wager goes. And fortunately, I was down and out on my luck. We were barely meeting payroll. There was a reluctance. People weren't sending us stuff. Word was getting out. I mean, people brought stuff in and we did surgeries and routine stuff. But Jack Vanberg, who had won the Derby with a horse named Alice Sheba, he was always so kind to me. And he had called me after winning the Derby. And it wasn't because I had some super skill. I'd love to tell you that, but it's not the truth. He called me because he knew I was straight up and that I would, if I worked for him, I'd tell him the truth. And I would always, any of the complicated cases, I'd be on the phone with the wizards all over the U.S. That's how I practiced, trying to get the best opinions and the best treatment plan. And he offered me a position as a resident vet. They were putting together a training center, and I was honored. But by then I had three families that had moved to Georgia, some of them with children. They had bought homes. I mean, I felt like these people were working for me, and I couldn't just go, oh, by the way, I'm shutting down the hospital because I can go make money in California. And I just didn't think it was the right thing. And I told Jack that, and he was nice. He was encouraging. And he said, you know, that's why I like you. You have that human side. And he said, is there anything I can do for you? And I said, Jack, we're just barely hanging on. We're meeting payroll, and it's a struggle, and it's hard to sleep at night. And Thursday nights, I pace the floor of my kitchen trying to think about all the payroll checks for the stall help, the vets, the vet techs, the staff, the front desk. It's a big nut to crack, and I've often dreamed of having a horseman seminar and spending my last wad of money I have available and promote that you're coming. And after winning the Derby, I think you're credible. You have something to say. And maybe we could gather the people that way, and they would see that Bob and I desire to bring people together and focus, highlight talented people like yourself. And Jack said, I'll come in a New York minute. So I called the Atlanta Constitution. I leaked a rumor. You got to think hard when you're living in a barn and you're not growing up with a silver spoon. You got to think your way through things. So I thought I'll call the paper, sort of leak a rumor that a Eclipse Award-winning Hall of Fame trainer who's won the Derby. And at that time, Alice Sheba was one of the highest earning horses of all times at that time. So all the stars lined up, and I said, this guy's flying in to Atlanta, and he's giving a talk at the Atlanta Athletic Club, which I think was $2,000 a night. And I used my last credit card to cover that thing. And he was coming in to give a horse talk in behalf of the new cutting edge surgical hospital that's just been open. And you know what? They took the bait. They came, they took pictures. They interviewed him when he landed. It was just, the stars had aligned, and Jack came and gave a phenomenal presentation. At that time, there was some old Georgia money. People had invested Cott Campbell. There were a lot of money in thoroughbreds. Several winglings came out of Georgia and went to Lexington for conditioning. Several of them made the select sale. There were a couple training centers. Georgia was hot and excited about thoroughbreds, and having Jack Vanberg come was the perfect plan. And Jack gave a talk. He's a straight shooter, common sense horseman. They gave him a standing ovation, and we just felt like the energy that night was infectious. But the miracle was unrehearsed to Bob and me. We did not ask him to say anything. We just thought being proxy to him, just the association with us, would give us some level of bare minimal, if you will, credibility. And at the end, he said, you know, Bob Brzee has done surgeries for me in New York. And he said, Hancock, I've known that boy for many, many years. And to be honest, I can't imagine putting two guys yoked the way they are with their passion, their experience, and their work ethic. I can't imagine what a talent this hospital is going to be. And that was unrehearsed. And I mean, that was like a shot of steroids. And he was really kind. And then he announced that he was clever. I mean, Jack didn't fall off the turnip truck. And he announced that he would consider bringing some horses from Churchill to us. And of course, there was some horse trading going on. If he brought four or five ankle chips or knee chips or something on a van, obviously they would want a little deal. But he did everything he could to help me. I sold him alfalfa hay when I was in vet school, and I would buy it out west, meet a semi at Churchill, and I'd unload hay from Saturday morning till Sunday night, get back and go to vet school. And Vanberg was just incredible. So that was our big break. And honestly, after that episode that evening, our phone started ringing. And then it was kind of fun. There were rumors that it was kind of like we were having a horse show at our clinic a lot of days, because the parking lot got full. And I give most of the credibility to Bob Brzee because of his unbelievable talent he had. And so we went ahead and just did fine. And it's all because of someone went above and beyond to help a long shot like me. So I'm forever grateful. And I tried in my gig now, working with vets, I always try to tell them that every gate that's closed, it may look closed, you may think there's no opportunity, but you got to figure a way to get on the other side of that gate. And sometimes it's just pushing on the gate and that rascal will open. That was a good gig for me.
When you were at Auburn, were you there with, there's three people I wanted to ask you about. Did you know David Pugh? Probably do.
I know him well. I don't think anybody can be within a mile of him and not know him.
Yeah. I agree.
And Rocky Bigby, who...
That's the other name I was going to ask you. Yeah. And then
Peter is a very close friend. And to tell you the truth, Rocky worked for me for a while. Rocky had finished the surgery residency. Yeah. And we have killed Bob. Bob worked like an army mule, but we were killing him. Those bellies, those colics, they just destroy you because they're always all night long. And then you clean up and then pre-purchases and lamenesses are coming in. And it felt like I was burning Bob out. So we thought, boy, if we've had somebody that's done a surgery residency, he could come in and help cut some of those bellies and give Bob a life. And yeah. Rocky worked for me about a year. He left nobly, but Rocky has so much going on, so much personality that he wasn't going to get in that trap of waking up in Waffle Houses like I did most of my life. Rocky was too smart for that, you know?
Yeah. And I get to see him almost every year at AP, and it's always amazing. And then Dr. Pugh, I mean, geez, I spent a lot of time in the truck with that guy in my career. And I'd love to have him on at some point, but I'm afraid to call him because every time I call, it's when I want something. And he definitely tells me that. It's like, the only time you ever call me is when you want something. So I got to call him just to see how he's doing. And then I'll call him later to see if he'll come on the podcast.
Yeah. You know, it's really funny how these relationships unfold. And John Schumacher was a professor at Auburn, and he's sort of an introvert, but he's got to be. And I, you know, some way or another, I've sort of been all over the globe, and John is just one of the smartest, most intuitive, humble veterinarians I ever met. And he was always so good to me, and to this day, I mean, John's in his, I don't know, early 70s, semi-retired, but still publishing, still working. I talked to him the other day. I guess there's probably very few weeks go by, maybe a couple weeks occasionally will go by, and I get to talk to him and just the relationships down there. And David Pugh, I mean, here's a guy that's boarded in nutrition and boarded in parasitology. That's sort of a different spin. You don't have many practicing veterinarians boarded in parasitology, but he was, and he had a good handle on nutrition. And he could sell snow to the Eskimos. You know that. He had that kind of personality. So, yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Hancock, when you say you would have done things differently, let's kind of talk about what the family life was like, how many of those kids are big horse vets these days. I'm an example. My dad's a vet and I'm not a vet. Yeah, tell us about anything you would have done differently, knowing what you know, and could you have done things differently, knowing how hard you work?
Yeah, honestly, yes. I think I was a product of the environment then. I mean, I lived in a farm that used to be across from Haggard's, and those guys were machines. I mean, they worked from early till late, and I grew up with vets at Churchill and Louisville and stuff, and they always work like that. So you grow up, the gold standard is you drink tons of coffee. You don't do anything but answer a pager and run calls. And that's really the wrong profile. And the problem that I had is that I was a long shot. I could not, it's another story in its own, but I part of the story, because again, being creative, I went to a bank and the little pompous, you know, they must have 13 vice presidents in every bank initially. And he gave me a really hard time and pretty much let me know, you know, you're a bum right out of school. You have no debt. Even your truck, although you don't owe on it, it's on its last leg, and you're trying to borrow all this money for a pipe dream, you know. He was pretty insultive, and I went home and paced the floor all night, and I decided I got to whoop this guy, and I got to figure it out. And so I changed it up. I had a small animal friend, the same guy that had a progressive small animal clinic, and I wore a white lab coat. I paid somebody to sew my name on it so I would look important. I put a stethoscope on, and I was in his clinic working. Now, back then, you know, bankers wouldn't know the difference between a horse doctor and a small animal. But his receptionist, I bought her lunch with the agreement that about every 5 or 6 minutes, she would say, Dr. Hancock, line one, Dr. Hancock, line two, California, Dr. Hancock, line three, Japan. I wrote out a protocol and we set it up and staged it. And I invited 4 banks that day. I didn't tell them I'd invited other people. And they said, well, make an appointment and come by. And I'm like, oh, no, I don't think you understand. If you can't take the initiative to come see me, I'll get a loan somewhere else. I just kind of got cocky. And boy, did they fall for it. So here we are in a small animal clinic. And there's 4 bankers sitting there on 2 benches with their briefcase. And, you know, they're all vice presidents. They're, like I said, they're 1 of 13 for a bank. They're all chuckling in the back room. And so occasionally I would go out front and, you know, line one, line two. And then I staggered their appointments 15 minutes apart. So I finally went out to the guy. I had a clipboard. I mocked. I learned how to walk with confidence. That's a skill I didn't have, but I walked like I was going somewhere. And I went out there and with the clipboard, cleared my throat and said, you must be so-and-so. Yes, sir, Dr. Hancock. Sounds like you're busy. I said, yeah, it's just another day. I said, look, you're going to have to be brief. I'll take you in one of these exam rooms. You got 14 minutes because there's 3 other banks here. Oh, my gosh, did that prime the pump. And yeah. They were, you know, it just kind of exaggerated the importance. By then, I paid a guy a case of beer to way overvalue all this surplus hospital equipment I had in a semi box trailer, and they valued it over $200,000. So that gave 20%. And I I was just like looking at my watch. They didn't see it was a Timex. But I was looking at my watch, clearing my throat and saying, hey, let's cut to the chase because I got to get back there. This is called meeting payroll. Do you guys understand that? Oh, yeah, we understand. And I said, okay. So anyway, I got a loan within 72 hours of that. I really did. And it's desire. So I was able to acquire a loan. But then what I wasn't smart enough to realize is big loans are big payments. And it wasn't long. It was $68,000 a month. I remember that number. I'll take it to my grave to pay for the trucks, the ultrasound, the portable x-ray, the data scope, the hydraulic table, the ventilators, the hoist that lifts the horse from the... I could write a book. And so all of a sudden, I was embedded in debt. And when you do that, you become a puppet on a string. So every time I might come home at 6 at night or 7 just to see the kids and maybe to have supper, maybe read to them before they went to bed, then the beeper would go and it'd be some banamine deficiency 60 miles away or a colleague coming in and it just... So you realize you're a victim of your debt. So, yeah, the major thing I would not do is tackle big debt. I proved I could get a loan, and I thought I was clever. But in the end, I realized I was a victim of being clever, and that is making the payment. I never missed a payment, but the same token, I think life would have been a lot better to just work out of the truck and keep the overhead way down. And when you have those slow days in the fall where vets get a little panicky because the phone's not ringing, school's starting, there's other activities, you don't have to worry. I would sweat bullets if I walked into my hospital barn and there wasn't horses out there in the stall hooked up to IV drips from a belly surgery or horses with bandages on their leg from an arthroscopic surgery. And we certainly had days and our weeks were the barn wasn't full. So, yeah, I would make it a huge point. I occasionally run into someone that has pee and vinegar like I may have had, and they open up to me and share, and I try to reel them back in, and I tell them the painful side. And the painful side is a divorce and hard feelings with kids. And fortunately, time and cures all those, but I would definitely do it better. I tell veterinarians, if you choose that life, get in with a group, a large group. And when you're on, turn it on. And when you're off, have enough confidence in your associates in the group to they'll do a good job for your clients within that practice. And that work-life balance, which is the new theme, is important. So, yeah, that's my regret. But once you're in heavy debt, I was taught by my dad, if you sign that dotted line, you better pay it or you better die trying. And that was that old Kentucky work ethic, I guess. But I'm not sure that's practicing smart. That was probably practicing hard. So yeah.
And this was the late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, I was in Ohio. I graduated in 85. I moved to Georgia, I guess, in 89.
Yeah.
And you know, built the hospital. There was a little recession. Interest jumped up, I think.
That was my question.
15%.
Yeah, your interest rates at that time of year. Yeah, that period in history were pretty bad.
Oh, people knew me. I had heart. And I mean, I literally went to barns. I'm ashamed to tell you this, but they trusted me. And I did a lot of dentistry at night, trying to bring in $1,000 or 800, whatever I could make extra, because I had families to feed. I mean, I had to sign their payroll checks, and I would go and sometimes start on teeth at 7 or 8 at night. This isn't smart, but I'd work till midnight, maybe later, and I'd leave a note on the stall. They trusted me. If a horse needed his teeth floated, I did it. If it didn't, or it could wait 6 months, I told them the truth. And there were clients I think knew I was trying. They probably saw the the beads of sweat on my forehead and knew this young man's hustling, you know. But that's not necessary. That's, you're owned by the material things instead of me owning them.
Along with the acting theme, a little bit of a lighter story. Recently, you had your colleagues with you at your farm. You took them on a wagon ride, North Georgia. If anyone here is old enough, they know the movie Deliverance. So would you tell that story about taking them on a wagon ride?
Well, it was funny. The PSVs and the with BI, they're just fantastic people. I tell you, we've got two boarded surgeons. We got a couple internal medicine people and then general practitioners. The chemistry among us is phenomenal. And we were going to have a gathering, and I asked Dr. Lyman, our new supervisor, who's a veterinarian and very well liked, could we do a little gig out in the mountains? I live in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, and I'll hook up a pair of horses and a wagon, and we'll go back in the mountain country. And we thought we would make it special. So we had a couple days of meetings, day and a half. So the plan was we all got together. I had a pair of Belgium horses that I had bought for a friend that has a boys' ranch. He's a veterinarian, and he let me use them in a nice touring wagon. So we loaded up in the wagon, and we had a few cigars and maybe a little wine, I think, and off we went. And I had staged it. They were talking about getting some corn liquor in those Appalachian Mountains. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to pull a little prank on them. So I had a fella that fits the role perfectly. He didn't have to act. It's bred into him. And he shows up in these dirty old bib overalls, no shirt on. His bib strap was hooked on one side and open on the other. And so I drive this team back this Appalachian road, and it's getting kind of in the wooded area. And I pulled over, and they go, what's going on here? I said, well, this is Appalachian curbside service. And they kind of looked at me. You're crazy, Hancock. What are you talking about? And I said, well, hang on. So we whistled, and what's going on here? I said, well, directly, as they say in the mountains, somebody's going to come through that holler, and we'll have a little delivery. And this guy came trotting through the holler with his dirty bib overalls, a hop sack with a quart of liquor, and a double-barrel shotgun in his arm. And as soon as he came running down, he started screaming at the vets, Doc, I told you they ain't supposed to look at me. He's real country. Tell them to look away. They ain't supposed to look. There was a deathly silence. And I gave him a $100 bill. It was part of the act. And he gave me this little burlap hop sack. I reached down, and it was peach brandy. And he kind of backed up in the woods, and he was backing up. Don't y'all dare look at me again. It could get violent, he said. And they're all looking away, and they didn't. And so off he trotted way back in the hall. Oh, it was fun. And I was just, it was everything I could do to keep from, breaking out laughing. Because the guy, he would win an Emmy for his actions and his acting. And so off we went down this road another mile or two, and the sun was it was getting a little later in the evening. There's an old missionary Baptist church that's up on a hill. It was built in 1822. It's pretty, has a big old steeple and a bell. And we pulled back towards that church, and maybe I got convicted or something, but it seemed like the sun was hitting that cross. And I thought, I just set up a big bold lie to my colleagues. And so I said, guys, I have to confess something. Well, they weren't hardly talking. They were still kind of flabbergasted why I would put them at risk and risk getting them shot. And I said that thing back there was staged. Well, I'm not going to name the vets' names, but two of them that I thought surely wet their britches, they said, oh, we knew that the whole time. And there's no way in heck they knew that. But they still laugh about it. To this day, they laugh about it. So, you got to create a little fun, and you got to have some laughs. So I think they really enjoyed it that night.
You might have missed your calling as a playwright or something. I mean, between this and the bankers, I mean, you might have had an acting career.
No, I don't. It's just a long shot. It's just, my dad was always pushing, figure your way out, boys. He'd blow that cigar smoke in our face at the farm. And, you know, we being boys, my brothers and I, you'd make excuses. Boys, boys, I don't want to hear about the birthing pain. Show me the doggy. We all three of us would shoot him the bird behind his back. But it was kind of like he used to say, the only good excuse is death. And right now, boy, both eyes are open, and I believe you'll go forward, you know?
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
I just wanted you to tell a Russia or Ukraine story, what happened over there, your travel.
Well, it was Romania.
Romania, yeah. Yeah. Tell us a little of that story.
Well, I just, that would be a whole new talk, but I got to go to Romania. I had gone to the Middle East for a guy and was sorely disappointed. I thought I had arrived. I was doing embryos and putting Egyptian embryos in these big draft mares. And honestly, secretly, I thought, boy, you've arrived. You're big time. I flew to the Middle East and worked for this crown prince in Qatar. Flew into Doha, Qatar. And honestly, I was never so disappointed in my life because the way he treated human beings. And so I was there, I think, about a week, maybe 10 days, and worked. And I came home and I wrote in my diary that I'd met the poorest man in the world because he measured his value by his things. And it just something really struck me about this guy and all my excitement about, quote, being in the big time. And it was just deflated. And then a few weeks later at AEP, there was a sign that said, free donuts, CVM. I didn't even know what CVM was, Christian Veterinary Medicine. Well, what caught my name, I'm a tightwad, and I get up early. I still wake up at 4. Free donuts, my light bulb went on. I thought, well, I'll go and roll dice with these boys. Well, it was a Christian Veterinary Mission meeting. And it wasn't a bunch of phony religion. It was different veterinary practitioners that shared some of the short-term shuttles they had. And they wanted a vet to go to Romania. Well, about the third chocolate donut cream stick, I got thinking, you know what, that might be sort of fun. And so somehow or another, it may have been the donuts or a sugar high. I later talked to one of the guys and said, you know, I think that'd be kind of fun. I'd like to go over there. That I went to Romania. I went 10 times, and each trip, it was a fantastic journey. You know, the people that know me in America, the bad rumor would probably say my reputation as a vet was so bad that I had to travel 8,000 miles, cross the big pond, and do work for free to have any horses to work on. And that's a reasonable assumption, but the fun thing is the noblest people I ever met up in the Maramure Mountains near the Ukraine, and people that sort of lived like Amish, they survived. No one was starving because they tried and they worked, but they all had horses, whether they're dragging logs out of the forest to keep from freezing in the winter or plowing for cabbage and potatoes. So a lot of good, fantastic stories. I could talk for hours, but it was fun. I ended up, we brought 11 Romanian students over to America that I met, and they were all long shots like me, and they kind of had the view the gate was shut, and I kept pushing them that the gate may have been shut, but it wasn't locked. And these are like my kids now. I mean, one of them is a fantastic vet. I think he's practicing in France now, has a surgery facility, pretty renowned. And yeah, it was just a blessing. It's like people encourage me, and somehow or another, I found myself in that role. So they would take another podcast, but there were a lot of neat journeys to Romania, a lot of people and lots of connections that I call them God winks. I mean, you're over there and somehow or another something goes right. I wasn't a Jimmy Swaggart faith healer. I was a general practitioner working on horses, and just anything you did to help those people, they were just so appreciative. And so I wouldn't trade it for anything. And so we could cover that at another time.
Yeah, we'll have to have you on it. Just talk about Romania.
Yeah, it's a beautiful car. I've got a close veterinary friend I've got talked into going over in June, and he's wanting me to go with him, and I think it'd be sort of fun, but I know he'd like it. Just really, really neat people. Very rugged, just survivalists. They live way up in those mountains, and tough, the toughest people I ever met. And, you know, for not knowing their language, the mission board always hired me a interpreter, and I'm such a workaholic, they had to hire two a day because I wore them out. I like to start at like 4:30. I know that's crazy, but let's get rolling. There was a lot of villages, and each time you go, they sort of know, and then they'd send word to an internet cafe that Doc's coming, and not that we did anything miraculous, but people always had a horse that needed injected or teeth needed floating or, you know, colts to castrate. And so it was really fun. So these interpreters, gosh, by about 1 PM, they were just shot. And I was just getting lubed up. I was ready to run. So, yeah, it was a good time. Very fortunate.
Yeah, speaking of the castrations, tell us about the equipment that you brought over that was much more modern than what they were used to.
Well, they were cutting horn. Most of the, I had a Russian tractor called a Belarus, and I've been to Russia, and I've been to Belarus. Minsk is the capital. The largest horse farm in the world is touted to be in Belarus, and I went over there, and all their equipment is pathetic. I had one of their tractors, and it was pathetic. And so when I went to Romania, I was going to cut a bunch of colts because there's 7 or 8 year old stallions going up and down the road in a wagon, and yet when they're tied, they get in the awfulest kicking matches. You know, studs don't get along with each other. And I would talk to the village vet, why don't you cut them? And he'd look at me, they bleed to death. And I looked at his instruments, and the emasculators, it looked like Ray Charles made them, and he was drunk. They wouldn't grab, they wouldn't crimp. And I soon realized those poor guys were using Russian-made instruments. And then, you know, if a horse died, that was half the man's wealth. So, yeah, so we went over and we started cutting horses. And I think any vet that's honest, that's still something that always made me beat up sweat. I've cut a lot of them, but you always wonder the fifth one or the 10th one or the 21st one that week. Is he going to go south? It's a humbling thing, but we cut a lot of horses, and then I ended up sending equipment over. I always made it a policy. We would try to find out who the village veterinarian was, because I thought it's pretty darn arrogant that I come over there with good drugs and nice instruments and make them look less than talented. And the truth of it is, some of those village veterinarians could sew a horse up with nylon fishing string, needle nose pliers, and a fish hook, and put a lot of us to shame. I marveled at their talent. They just had nothing to work with. And so I always made it a policy in any village we would go and meet the vet. Now, they were real standoffish, but remember, I was really seasoned in having vets not like me, and I was good at winning them over. And so I would tell them, if you'll ride with us, we'll work together. I need you because of your wisdom and your knowledge about what's going on in your village. I'm only passing through. And then I would bait them by saying, and by the way, I've got a lot of supplies and some instruments I don't have room to take back. If you would consider having them, I would be honored to give them to you. Well, even if they didn't like me, you know, over there, free instruments was hard to turn down. And I made so many friends doing that. That was fun. From calf jacks to little glass sterilizers where you'd cold sterilize to, I took the first ultrasound, I think, that the nation of Romania ever had, first portable ultrasound over there. And I smuggled the first x-ray machine in. And they were anti-X-ray in Romania because of Chernobyl. They had it all wrong, and they really threatened if anyone was caught with radiation-emitting equipment, they'd be subject to, you know, to prison and stuff. And we found a group of people from a church sending over canned goods, and I put it in the third row of jelly jars, and we got it smuggled in there, and bought the guy the first camera, digital camera. I think that thing was like 2 megapixels. It was like $700, and this guy was just such a smart and little makeshift view box. He would take digital pictures and then ride his bicycle to an internet cafe and send me x-rays. And it, you know, we did that for several years. Now it's allowed. But yeah, it was fun. The first x-ray in Romania was from a little machine I took over that I'm aware of. Maybe small animal or a university might have had a machine. Surely they did, but not out in the rural mountains. That was all strictly forbidden because of their ignorance and thinking radiation was going to spread and stuff. So a lot of good memories.
We could be here all day, but you're a busy man. And we said an hour and a half, so we're going to stick to that. Your job, you're still working as a professional service vet, and you ride along with sales reps, and you see a lot of veterinarians. This podcast has been interrupted 6 or 7 times just because you're so popular and everyone's calling. You've made so many relationships, so many friends.
It's pawn shops. I got bad credit.
So I'm just curious what you're seeing out there as far as a pulse on the industry, the equine industry, and then what kind of encouragement would you give veterinarians out there? And have you thought of any solution to the challenges that are out there?
Well, that's a $1 million question. I number one, they work smart, not hard. I did the opposite, so I stand in awe. Number two, though, you got to have passion. I mean, whether I'm supposed to get off at 4 o'clock, if some horse has a corneal scratch or is ripped its side open, I'm to a fault. I'd feel like I have to go. And it was hard to say no. And there's got to be some happy median. In my travels with this gig, I find some of the happiest veterinarians I've ever met are mixed practitioners. And I'm sure not shortchanging my equine friends, because that's all I did was equine. We did a little bit of beef cattle for the reason we could be listed as a mixed large animal vet, and our insurance was half the cost. So we might pregnancy check a few cows once or twice a year. But the happiest vets I meet do a little bit of everything, and I find them to have a good balance. They've been so kind. Some of them actually have me come into their homes. They have me for dinner. They'll pick me up at the hotel. They're like friends, and I think more than anything, I've encouraged them that you're on top of your game, and they say, "Yeah, but you're a big equine guy." What does that mean? That means that we inject joints and pass a tube and anything. That they do a ton of things. They do an LDA, an RDA. They may spay a cat and a dog, and even put a pin in a dog's leg, and all those things that I can't do. So, I think there's got to be something to get into a group, and when you're on, turn it on. Be the best you can be. Have enough pride. Take the watch off, and if you're in the middle of something and it's going good and it's 4 o'clock, stay with it. But that's hard to instill passion in people. I see a wealth of opportunity. I love to talk to students. I really like to be able to allow to go to a vet school and reach out to them. I have a sense of humor, and you know, within 5 minutes, if they realize you're not cocky and you don't think you're God's gift to vet medicine, you're just somebody that was fortunate enough to get in and do what I wanted to do and made a good trip out of it, people will listen to you. And I think there's a world of opportunity. Every practice I'm in, if I know the owners, they'll call me or pull me in their office and say, "Hey, you get along with people. People like you. You're personable. In all your journeys, I'll pay you a headhunter fee. I desperately need people with passion. I've got to have help. Do you know anybody?" And the truth of it is, I don't. And the second truth, I think it's kind of unethical for me to steal a talented employee from one practice where the vet's my friend and recommending to another to put some Ben Franklins in my pocket. Of course, maybe I'm not that good at business, and that's why I'm old and still working. But I just think there's a borderline ethics thing there. But I think there's a world of opportunity, and that, you know, I worry that the property is becoming diminished. You know, pasture of farms, a lot of this over time is changing into subdivisions, and we've got to have, I always told my new interns, it's always a sugar daddy or sugar mama principle. When they pull into a farm and see a $250,000 entrance with waterfalls and very, you know, statues and sculptures of horses and foals, be careful, get your money, because the bigger they are, the harder they fall. The equine business is inherently a money losing business. It will always be that way. And so we have to be affordable, in my view, to have business. And we have to help our clients arrive at solutions and not empty the bank on every case. So there's some fine line there, because we need folks with money that don't get disenchanted and say, the heck with it, I'm getting out. I'm spending a couple $1 million a year at this dressage barn with my plan, and it's really not working, and I'm going to get out. And you know, we all see that. We witness it a little bit, and that alarms me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks for your time, Dr. Hancock. You're a good friend. We could listen to you all day.
No, I just ramble. I'm sorry. I kept envisioning you guys pouring coffee. Now you're on espresso going, when is this guy going to shut up?
No.
But you know, life is a journey, and mine's not any better than anyone's. It's just, it's the way you take it, you know, that
yeah.
You know, I've shared with you, Ryan, C.S. Lewis has this saying, it's phenomenal. And he says, you know, hardships often prepare ordinary people for an extraordinary destiny. And hardships shouldn't define us. They should direct us, you know. You're either defined by it and you live under the umbrella, well, I had a hardship, or you take the challenge on and you be creative. But golly, there's so much, as you guys both know better than I do, there is so much opportunity right now in the equine world, and whether you're a veterinarian or really talented reps, people that have the personality, that care, connect with doctors, and they're not overbearing. There's still a shortage of them, I think. And
yeah,
there's just a lot of opportunity, and people shouldn't be going hungry and sticking their hands out and asking for handouts. It's all around them. There's milk and manna and honey right above them. They just got to pull the right string and behold, you know.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you. I appreciate, I mean, if no one's going to know this until now, but Dr. Hancock pulled over. He's running an errand. He's sitting in his truck. We had some technical difficulties, but he's a trooper. Made this happen. So I really appreciate it.
Well, it's an honor to be a part of this. You know, one of the fears, you get older, you kind of feel forgotten. And I've always enjoyed talking to older veterinarians and hearing their perspective, because you can glean something. You know, those that understand a little history may not make the same mistake. And so, yeah, I think I appreciate you guys doing this. And I hope someone, if they can't sleep one night, might listen to this and realize, hey, I need to have a different attitude. I'm going to push on that gate, because, you know, that lock may not be locked. So thank you both.
Thank you, sir.
Nugget. Yeah, thank you for that. It was a real pleasure to meet you. So.
Honor, I'd love to see you. You're out there in the promised land. I think heaven is somewhere near Montana.
Yes.
I just love it out there.
I feel like I want to go back and listen to this again and just dissect, but what an amazing human being. And not only that, but there's two big things that he said. There's themes in this that really stuck with me. The adversity that you face is not like, don't, he said this at the end, but don't let it define you. and then like find a way to, you know, work hard, persevere, and it leads to a greater path and a greater destination. And I think that's a great inspiration. But I was also struck by what he said about that guy that he went to work for in the Middle East, that he said was the worst man in the world because of the way he treated people. And you could see that in his philosophy, like he not only had a passion for horses, but he had a passion for people. And he put those two things together, and it, I think it makes a really outstanding equine veterinarian.
Yeah, he felt responsible.
Right.
For things outside of himself. I guess the more you care about others, the more goal for yourself. I mean, just, it comes back.
For sure.
A lot of good stories in there.
Collected friends through a career of being an equine veterinarian. I'm sure that's what he values the most.
You two are very similar, because if I will be somewhere and you say, oh, you know so and so, ah, you know so and so, I'll be at one of my vets, and they'll say, oh, do you know so and so? And of course, you know them. Dr. Hancock knows them.
Yeah,
I guess it's a small enough world, but it's just wild. All the different connections that
hopefully through the podcast we get to meet. Even more of them. I get to meet even more equine vets, you know, like Dr. Hancock and, Yep.
All right, we'll call that volume one. Yeah, definitely enjoyed that. Yeah, we'll have him on again.
For sure. Absolutely.
Yep, like you said.
All this stuff he said, like he's like his dad, the country sayings. I mean, I'm just like, I'm still unpacking, man. So I'm excited to actually listen to this one. I listen to all of them after we post them, but. I'm excited to listen to this because I feel like there's going to be just full of nuggets, golden nuggets. Yeah.
Yep. And like you said, you know, you pull the string and then just let it go. Yeah. And the guy's just full of so much wisdom, and he's so honorable.
Not every closed gate is locked.
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Well, hopefully someone gets a notepad out for this episode, writes down all these important sayings. All right. Enjoy the promised land, John.
All right, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Yeah. Bye.
Do you have feedback? Community is the primary mission of the podcast. Do you have a comment or suggestion from an episode? For an opportunity to be featured, please record your feedback on our website's feedback sidebar button. You can record up to 5 minutes. For more about Valio Mentis, go to valiomentis.com. Find us on Facebook and Instagram. If you want to support this project, please click on the Patreon link in the show notes. If you enjoyed, please subscribe, rate, and review. Thank you.